This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
Some would say that not all men are created equal. Some are born with a broken compass and get lost amongst the wilderness of the world, having a hole inside that they attempt to fill with bad behavior. The path you travel does not have to be the course you stay. Change comes in recognizance and accountability for your own actions. A true miracle is a changed life and the equalizer amongst all human beings. The great Greek poet Sophocles writes, "All men make mistakes, but a good man yields when he knows his course is wrong and repairs the evil. The only true crime is pride." I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Felice, and on this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we have a very special guest. We welcome John Sullivan to discuss the suffering of the streets. John's going to show you what a changed life can do for you, and it's extremely inspiring, but it does get a little bit dark. John, thank you so much for traveling all this way, coming to see us. Another connection through Hoboken.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Stewie brought him in, right?
So that's it. Stewie's the man. Stewie calls me up, and it's, hold on, let me see if I can do my best, Stewie. Like, "Hey, bro, I got this guy. You're not going to believe his story." Something like that. They do a good job.
You did a good job.
You know, Stewie and the whole Hoboken
that
crew,
whole Hoboken contingent.
Benny Love. And John's a good friend of Jerry Cooney, who is your best friend, isn't he?
Yeah. I went down to Philadelphia with him at dinner.
Stay away from Chuck Wepner and any nicknames that Chuck may or may not have with Jerry. He doesn't really care for him too much. John, thanks so much for coming.
You're welcome.
You know, before we get started in anything, let's give a big shout out to Toyota of Hackensack. They help us keep the lights on, and they are our marquee sponsor. We don't trust anybody, but we do trust Toyota of Hackensack. So if you're looking for a car, go to toyotahackensack.com. Let them find you a car.
You know, Kev, they help keep the lights on. Those lights are bright. They really are. Yeah, we got to thank Andrew for that.
So, John, each week we take a message from our audience. It's our social media question. This week, I pulled this one specifically for you, hearing your story, talking to you so much. And it comes from Tanya M. "If you had a time machine, what would you change about your former life? If you have one chance to go back and change one event, what do you think it would be? You're our guest. I'm going to pass this off to you."
I'd honestly have to say I changed what I did to my grandmother, the way I treated my grandmother.
How so?
She raised me, and I tortured her.
Yeah, with just going out and doing stuff?
With threatening her, with wanting money, get me money.
Really?
Break windows if she wouldn't get me money.
Is it like taking love for granted?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what was her reaction when you would threaten her, ask her for money?
She would get it for me.
Really?
She would go anywhere, and she would get it. She would borrow it.
That's what I'm saying, by taking love for granted, because you knew she was going to be there for you. If she laid the hard hand one time and said,
I abused it.
Yeah.
Well, where do you think that line is? That's a good point. Like, where do you think the line is between tough love and showing real compassion? Because your grandmother, it sounds like she showed you compassion, even though you think you're not worthy for it. But then there's a point where tough love becomes necessary. Do you think if she gave you a little bit of tough love, you wouldn't have done so much?
I don't think my grandmother was like that. You know, I grew up with no parents. You know, my father died when I was two and a half, and my mother took off, and my grandmother would not let anybody touch me, no matter what I did.
You were her precious gift.
Yeah.
And she had seven kids of her own.
Damn. Irish Catholic. It's got to be Irish Catholic. Yeah. Mike, what do you think? If you had a time machine, one moment, what would you go change? Don't say it. Think of something different. Change your mind.
I'm going to say the day I was born, maybe. Yeah. It's been all downhill from there. There's two obvious things. You know, the one that I won't say. And like you said, you know, the incident that we went through. You know, I always said, everybody says, if you could do something different, what would you have done? I said, I would have made a left instead of making a right, because I would have never been involved in that. Changed my life forever.
That's a tough one. Is that a blessing or a curse, that moment?
Yeah, no kidding. You know, you could take it in both ways.
You know, we talked about it a little bit on Instagram Live. That's why I'm saying it's that.
It's a curse because of what happened to us, but it's a blessing because of what we've become. You know, and if it wasn't for that incident, you said it before, we've known each other for 25 years. But if it wasn't for both of our incidents
happening so close to each other,
we would have never been in a studio together.
That's right. So there's good that comes out. There's always that light. It's just, it's so dark, you can't see it at the time.
Yep.
You know,
but they say when you're going through that darkness, there's always someone standing next to you, but it's so dark, you can't see that person.
But they got night vision on. I've made so many mistakes in my life.
I mean, like I said before, we can make a whole episode out of this.
I don't, you know, one that obviously when I bullied Jay Aponte when I was in seventh and eighth grade, because I always felt bad about that. If I had a time machine, I would like to get myself directly after my shooting. For the main reason, saying, take it easy on your wife. I tortured my wife. I mean, I tortured her because I wasn't right. You know, it wasn't what she did so much. Every wife, you know, pushes your buttons here and there, but she didn't do it intentionally. She's a very kind woman. But I treated her so poorly. I would just want to have 5 minutes with myself saying, take it easy on her because you don't know what's happened to you. How do you expect her to know what's happening to you? I don't know whether it would have changed my behavior, would have changed, but at least it would have given me, it wouldn't have damaged her so much because I know my incident damaged her. Yeah.
Aren't there times of like you just look back and you want to smack yourself in the face for saying like, why were you such a fucking asshole at that point?
Why do you do it? I mean, yeah. I'm sure you had.
You know, my grandmother, she did everything she could for me.
Yeah.
She sent me to Catholic schools and I was kicked out of every Catholic school in my neighborhood. I was. St. Stephen, St. Jean, St. John, St. Joseph, St. Vincent's. I was kicked out.
Yeah. You're running out of saints.
Exactly. And then.
You notice they're all Hoboken, like, you know, like all Italian names.
Oh, yeah.
And she would work three jobs to send me to these schools because we were on welfare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you turn around and you look at yourself when you were younger and you say, kid, don't you see what people are sacrificing? It's, you know, unfortunately, young people are very selfish. It's not their fault. They're very selfish people. They think of the world just wrapped around their own head and they're not looking at what people are doing in order to provide for them or do for them or if it's in their best interest. All they're looking about is how is this going to benefit me? They don't do it purposely.
You know, I say all the time though, life should be lived in reverse.
Oh yeah.
You're born in diapers, you die in diapers, right? So why not start from the day you died? You wouldn't make those mistakes through your life.
Yeah.
You'd know better by the time you were a teenager.
You know, it was the streets that did it to me. You know, my grandmother did the best she could. You know, and once I got involved with the guys that were older than me and we started doing the drugs, it was all over.
Tanya, thank you so much for sending that question in. Keep sending in your questions. We're going to try to get them on the air. Thank you. I mean, that was a fun one.
Yeah. Like I said, we could have went all day with that.
You know, other than we could have gone for the low-hanging fruit and say, hey, listen, I would have bought stock in Apple in the late 70s or IBM or something like that.
But well, when you asked that question, I was going to say, do you mean like starting today or through my life?
Or I got yesterday's lottery numbers or anything, but that doesn't really change. I don't know if money's really the answer to anything. So, John, you're a New York guy. You lived a really incredible life from what you've told me so far. But where'd you grow up?
I grew up on the Upper East Side of Yorkville in the 70s, 80s, 90s. It's called Germantown. Some people know it as Yorkville. And
residents know it as Yorkville.
I grew up with, you know, living with my grandma. She did the best she could. But she would go to sleep at 9 o'clock at night, and I would go down the fire escape and out and around and hang out in the corner, you know, in the corner or the schoolyard and with the older guys.
Well, you had mentioned that your father died very young.
Yeah, when I was 2 and a half.
Now, where was your mother?
My mother took me and my sister and dropped me and my sister at my grandmother's, her mother, and she took off, and I never saw her again for probably till I was about 15 or 16 years old.
Really?
When you saw her 15, did she say why she did it or anything? Did you make amends with her?
I wanted nothing to do with her.
Really?
I didn't even want to look at her.
Yeah. Really? You were.
I was very angry.
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I used to go to school and Father's Day, Mother's Day, and I'd get made fun of. They'd make fun of me, you know, because my grandmother would be there all the time.
How old were you when you got dropped off?
2 and a half, and my sister was 2.
Wow. So you didn't even really know your mother.
My sister was like maybe 1 and a half. My sister's like 13 months younger than me.
True Irish twins right there. But, you know, your grandmother did. Was your grandfather around?
No, he wasn't.
Yeah. Now, your grandmother was all of a sudden saddled with these two very, very young children. What was her reaction? Did you ever sit and talk to her and say, you know, what was it like, what do I do now?
No.
No.
I was so angry that I didn't want to talk to anybody. It was just, you know.
You think the anger from your mother, you took it out on your grandma?
I think the anger from not having a father, not having parents. And, you know, they told my grandmother when I was about 5 or 6 years old, she had about a year to live.
Wow.
And she lived another 20 years.
You know, it's a funny statistic. So they say 70 to 80% of incarcerated people in this country come from a fatherless home.
Yeah.
That's the statistic. There is credence to that because of that anger buildup. Your father and it's a necessary thing to have parents because they are there to teach you life lessons, to let you off the leash a little bit, but also to reel you back in when you need it. And not having that, what did it do to your psyche on that besides anger? How else did this come out?
I just was defiant against anything and everything. You know, I didn't want to go to school. Never wanted to go to school.
What age did all this start?
12, 13, you know. And then my uncles and aunts would keep me home on the weekends to serve them their Schaefer and their Budweiser and their 7-and-7s. And like a good 13-year-old, I would take sips. And I would, you know, get
one for you, one for me.
And then 6 months later, I was in the card game drinking full beers. Because back then in 73, 74, you get away with it. No.
Wait, was it 18 back then for?
No. If you served a 13-year-old today, they find out you'd be in jail. I used to drink them with them all the time once I got, you know, I'd be in the poker game.
And your uncles didn't have a problem with you sitting there throwing back?
I got drunk once or twice. I got dizzy, fell down. They put me in the bed. But as soon as I started handling it, they would be the ones getting drunk.
And now that his aunts and uncles didn't have to worry about the little bratty kid running around. Right. You got him drunk, you put him in bed, and he's sleeping all night. Right.
So they kept me inside, you know. And, you know, I had my chances because, you know, when I was 14 years old, I was working in a deli on 76th and 2nd Avenue, Eastmore Deli. And George Steinbrenner of the New York Yankees walked in.
Really?
And I knew who he was. And the owner said, you don't know who he is. And I said, no, I know that Steinbrenner. I was a big Yankee fan. And he gave me his phone number, and he took a liking to me. But I was already taken by the street. I wanted no part of it. He wanted to send me to school. You know, he sent money to my house on Christmas Day.
George Steinbrenner.
I lived on 74th, 75th, and 2nd Avenue.
I'm going to say, let's go back to the social media question then.
Yes. Yeah, time machine. Yeah. He might have kept that number.
Yeah, and he wanted to do good things for me, but I just...
George Steinbrenner, and listen, I know you're not a Yankee fan. George Steinbrenner has done so many good things for so many people and doesn't want the accolades for it. Like you said, a guy I went to high school with was an Olympic swimmer. He was in the 92 Barcelona Olympics. Marching into the stadium, my friend's father died of a massive heart attack. George Steinbrenner heard that my friend wanted to go to medical school. George Steinbrenner paid for him to go to medical school.
Right. He actually does it for, he did it for 20, I knew he did it for 25 kids a year.
Yeah.
He would send me to Saks Fifth Avenue with his secretary to buy $500 suits. When the Yankees were playing at Shea Stadium, when the old Yankee Stadium was redone in 74, 75, I would go there, and the people that worked at the front office would have to call me Mr. Sullivan. And they would say, Mr. Sullivan, how many are with you? And I would just take in tons of my friends to the games.
You know, this is not the first time, obviously, I've heard about your friend. I'm hearing this about your reaction to or your interaction with George Steinbrenner. But how about something as small? We have a friend, Scott Stevens. Scott's a little person. And Scott went to Yankee Stadium, and it was ball cap day. He gets his ball cap, goes on there, and it just unraveled. Like, it just unraveled. And here's a little kid who, you know, remember the giveaway days at the stadiums? It's a big deal to get those things. And most of it was junk. But he writes a letter, a handwritten letter, as a little kid to George Steinbrenner. George Steinbrenner sends him a team hat, like a real hat. And so those stories about George Steinbrenner, I have to believe that although the man was bigger than life, what he was, he had a really good heart.
Huge heart. Yeah. Huge heart.
And it just takes those people to believe in you.
You know what it was? The anger and the chaos got to me because when I turned 16, 2 days over 16, that's when it really started to go downhill. I was 2 days over 16. I was with my friend John. John was 6'4". He was about 280. I was about 5'4" and weighed about 110 pounds. And we got arrested for doing something bad. And we went to the 19th precinct, and his father, which was bigger than him, came in and slapped him in the head. And he went home, and because I was 2 days over 16, I had to go to Central Booking. I had to be fingerprinted and go downtown.
As a 16-year-old kid putting in with some...
That was the first time I would be arrested, and I would get arrested a lot more after that.
So as a 12- and 13-year-old sort of going down the wrong path, what did some of the bad behavior... Tell me some of the bad behaviors that you exhibited.
And when I was 10, 11, and 12 in school, I would spit balls at the nuns, you know. I was a lefty, and a nun hit me with a ruler with a thumbtack in it in my left hand. And out of reaction, I smacked it with the right. And I thought I was going to hell. The priest looked at me. I thought I was going to hell.
I see. I have similar experiences in Catholic school.
Catholic
grammar school.
I wanted to be like, so whatever the other people would tell me to do, I would do.
I was going to say, did you do that for attention?
For attention, yeah. Because I would get up in the middle of my aunt's and uncle's house. I would get on the kitchen table, the living room table, and I would start dancing. And, you know, I wouldn't want to take pictures. I wouldn't want to put clothes on. You know, I was, you know, all kinds of attention like that.
Well, it makes perfect sense not having a father, because
a mother at that point.
Who's the two people in your life who are accepting of you no matter what? Usually, not in all households, but usually it's your mother and your father. They're your rock. They're your basis, the people who believe in you more than you believe in yourself. And to go out and look and seek that acceptance that you're missing from your parent. Not to get into a child psychologist, I'm not a child psychologist, but it sounds perfectly logical. And how did your school misbehavior translate into the street or spill over into the street life?
Or did street life spill over into your school?
I stopped going to school. You know, my grandmother worked in Wagner's school. My grandmother worked in the school as a custodian. She also was the super of some buildings. So when the truant officer would come there and look for me, she'd say, he's not here. Mm. But I'd be in the closet or I'd be up on the roof. You know, so she was enabling me.
Yeah.
You know, and my uncles were always beating me. You know, they used to beat me all the time with the belt or a broom or something. And, you know, it got to a point when I was 13 or 14 years old and I wouldn't cry anymore. I said, I'm not crying.
Yeah, you don't want to give them the satisfaction. I'm not. Well, there's this story, I think it's Good Will Hunting. His father, Robin Williams, is telling the story of his father coming upstairs, and he just wanted to beat on somebody, so he had to wrench his belt and something else, and he'd make the kid choose, which one do you want? And Robin Williams says, you know, I went with the belt or something, and the kid goes, well, I take the wrench. Well, why would you take the wrench? Because F him. That's what he said. And he didn't want to give him the satisfaction of knowing that he got to him. So yeah, that's fair to say. Now, your crimes while starting out, not crimes, but bad behavior started out minor. When did it start gravitating towards more serious stuff?
I wasn't going to school and I was working in the streets, you know. I was doing for the loan sharks and the bookmakers and, you know.
Were you
collecting running numbers,
yeah.
You know, stuff like that. I also was selling drugs.
What kind of drugs at the time?
Pot. At that time. Yeah. 76, 75, 76, it was pot.
Well, pot and acid were probably big back then.
Yeah, nah, it was just weed. Weed, you know, but always getting drunk. A lot of weed, that was a big thing back then.
You go broke now.
But then I just started getting in deeper and deeper and deeper, you know.
Like how so? Owing people or?
Owing people, you know, I started getting into gambling, you know.
Now, were you smoking weed back then, too?
Yes. I only smoked weed for like 2 years. I really didn't like it.
Yeah.
I did it to be part of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was more of a drinker. I love to drink.
Again, that's acceptance.
Yeah.
But how bad did that get as a young man? You said you got arrested when a couple days over 16. What was that for?
That? Robbery.
Yeah. That was for robbery. So it graduated from drugs to robbery?
Robbery, yeah.
What was it?
The robbery was to get drugs. Yeah,
going and sticking somebody up, or
yeah,
that's all you're doing.
No, it was that kind. It was a mugging.
Oh, no, straight up,
that would force.
And at this time, where's your grandmother?
She's home, but my grandmother was always there because every time I got locked up, she was down in the court. I was ROR to her. Yeah.
I was
2 days over 16.
She must have been out of her mind.
She didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
I was so angry that you couldn't talk to me.
Support for the Suffering Podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who's the best in men's below-the-waist grooming.
Their products are precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped Performance Package is the ultimate men's hygiene bundle.
Inside the package, you'll find the Lawnmower 4.0, Weed Whacker Ear Nose Hair Trimmer, and the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant.
And we also got the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. This thing is a life changer. Along with that,
boxer briefs.
I'm going to tell you what, these are like high quality boxer briefs, and this is no joke. I'm not saying this just because their Manscaped sent it to us. These are nice. My boys are going to be quite happy in there.
And you can't tell Kevin's wearing them under the table right now. And we also have a nice travel package.
Join over 8 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer just for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code TSP at manscaped.com.
Jesus Christ, that's a lot of balls.
You know what I mean? It's simple. It's the simple thing. You say black, it's blue. Mm. She just didn't want to hear nobody.
She'd probably pick you up from court, read you the riot act, and you just went in one ear, out the other, and you were probably out on the street the next day doing the same thing.
I mean, I was 16 years old, coming home drunk every night, coming home and passing out on the bed.
Do you remember your mindset when you were 16?
As far as what?
As far as how much you think you knew about the world?
I knew nothing.
But back then, I bet you thought you had.
I thought I did.
You thought you knew everything.
Yeah. And only after you got older did you realize how foolish you were.
I thought I was a crazy kid. I carried a slapjack. Then after that, I graduated to carrying other things, you know?
Yeah.
I was small, but I was crazy. Because I remember the first time I got beat up in Wagner's Yard, I came home crying, and my grandmother said, "What happened?" He hit me. She slapped me, stopped crying, gave me a bat. Let's go around the corner and get him. My grandmother was an old-time lady. And I wouldn't do it. She took the bat and she chased the guy.
So your grandmother had some pepper in her.
People were afraid of my grandmother.
Yeah,
she raised seven kids. She, four boys. Yeah, they were afraid of her.
Yeah, you don't have too much time to screw around with coddling kids when you got seven of them,
especially when you're working.
So when my grandmother would tell my uncles, "Leave him alone," they'd leave me alone.
Okay,
they were afraid of her. Yeah,
so she was your ultimate protector. You know, if you were to put yourself in your grandmother's shoes back the way you were back then, do you think that there's anything she could have said that would have gotten through?
No, she tried.
Not to a street 16-year-old.
She tried.
At what point did she give up at some point?
No, she never gave up. Never.
That's a beautiful thing.
She never gave up until she got senile. I'll tell you when you ask about me later years when I went and did when I did the time.
So how bad did it get as far as your crimes on the street?
It got pretty bad.
Yeah, give me an example.
What's like the worst one?
I got deep where there was two guys in the neighborhood, two older Irish guys that were like brothers to me. I won't use their names. And they said, you know, you could do 12 and a half to 25 if you get caught for what you're doing. And they beat the hell out of me.
What were you doing?
Armed robberies.
Yeah. Did you get any, was it just strictly money or you got a little acceptance or a little juice when you did it?
Street cred?
I was scared as hell. Scared as hell. But did it because I needed it.
And was it to feed your habits?
To feed my living, the way I like to live.
And what was, like, did you see any future or you just thought you were always going to be a street guy?
No. I didn't see any future. I could honestly tell you, I don't know. But I know I did about seven of them. And then after I found out it was 12 and a half to 25, I told the other two guys I was doing it, and I'm not doing it anymore.
Now you said you worked in a deli. Did you have any other job after that?
No, that was when I was 14.
You never had?
No, and the neighborhood I grew up in, I could have had plenty of jobs, doorman jobs, sanitation, construction. I never had any interest in working.
Because you didn't want a boss? Or was it just you enjoyed the quick, fast money?
I enjoyed the fast lane.
Yeah.
You know, going to the after hours, you know, the bars and the after hours and stuff like that.
Now, I imagine you being such a crazy kid in the neighborhood, you got sort of a reputation. Listen, if you want to see what John will do, hold on. John, go take care of this. Was that the type of person that you were?
There was people afraid of me, yes.
Yeah.
They would cross to the other side of the street when they saw me coming. They didn't.
You definitely had to have a nickname growing up on the street, though. Or were you just Crazy John?
No, they're just Sully.
Sully.
Sully. Yeah, Sully.
So, no, I was gonna, no, that's somebody different. You didn't fly planes, did you?
No.
That's a great landing.
As you matriculated in this fast lane life, if you had to pick out one of the worst things that you're most regretful of, what do you think it is?
Probably doing the robberies.
Yeah.
You know, they thought I wouldn't make, they used to say I wouldn't make 18. I wouldn't make 20, you know. And I didn't think I would either.
Did you ever feel bad for the victims?
Nah.
No.
I never hurt anybody.
Yeah. Just threatened.
No, I just, my part was to just handcuff them. Tie him up, handcuff him.
No kidding.
You know the guys with the strong arm guys?
Yeah, we all had guns. We all had guns. And, you know, I just didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
I really could tell you now that I was out of my mind to do something like that because it's just not normal.
Well, guns, it's my understanding that guns were somewhat easy to get back then. You know, I think until 81, when President Reagan was shot, you could go into a pawn shop and buy a gun after the Brady Bill. It all changed and everything. How easy was it for you to get a gun?
Well, one of my partners was an Italian guy that had the guys, the boys would
blame
give
it on the Italians.
The boys would give it to him. You know, and like I said, when I stopped, they got another guy. And on the next job, the Italian guy got killed.
No kidding.
Yeah, because the guy that took over for me didn't do the job, didn't search the guys, didn't search the customers, didn't make sure they had nothing, didn't handcuff them.
Didn't do his job.
Didn't do his job. And when they were leaving the store, the owner put two in his back.
You know, I know you're a retired laborer, but think about this in terms of your crew of people you worked with. All right. If you have one guy on that crew that is not doing their job, the other guys in that world can get hurt. So it's not only the criminal world. You got a job to do. Cops are the same way. You know, if we had a guy that was on a certain job, didn't do his job, one of us could get hurt. You know, and unfortunately that seemed to happen there. Did the crime families, I mean, I don't know, you're Irish, so maybe you're Westie or something like that. Did they ever show any interest in you?
I didn't like guns. Even though I carried them. That's why I didn't like guns, or I would have been involved.
That was my career in law enforcement. I didn't like guns, but I carried one.
I would have been involved, but I didn't like the weapons because after collecting money for such a long time, then they wanted to step up the game, and I got out.
Well, who did you collect money for? What gang did you collect?
For families.
For families?
Yeah.
We'll keep it at that.
Did you get a look inside of that world? Because it's very glamorized now on TV. The world of the mafia, you know, everybody, I was here. I've seen where I grew up. I've seen the ugliness behind that world. Did you get a glimpse of that where you didn't want any part of it?
No, I wasn't, you know, I was small potatoes. You know, I wasn't involved in that big stuff. I knew a lot of stuff, but I didn't get involved in it. You know, I was, you know, more or less doing like the football sheets or the bookmaking, stuff like that. I wasn't in that big.
Catholic schools are great for that. Yeah. You should have stayed in school. You would have made more money. Because that's what I did in my high school. Yeah. To the priest. I actually was doing it with a priest. And the priest got caught, and that was the end of
the football tickets back in the day.
I was constantly getting locked up.
For petty stuff?
For assault.
Yeah.
But somebody was always there to make sure the witness didn't show up.
Really?
Back then, yeah. You know, the DA couldn't continue the case because somebody didn't show up. The person that pressed charges in the beginning never returned to court.
Was it an uncooperative witness?
So, you know, there was a lot of times where I should have gone away and I didn't.
When you first...
But see, now that only fuels your fire.
Now you think you're invincible.
Now you think, hey, I could do it again and get away with it.
I you know what? I never hurt nobody.
Yeah.
I didn't ever hurt nobody. These assaults were for fights in bars and stuff like that. You know, it wasn't, you know, I'm an Irishman. I would get drunk and I would get into fights.
back of your neck gets red. Yeah, yeah.
Notre Dame's a Fighting Irish. I mean, come on.
So when, that first time you get put in handcuffs and put down, and you're in big boy jail, what's going through your head at that point?
I'd like to know what was going through the cop's head, because his name was John Sullivan. And he had to tell his partner, "Oh, you lock him up. I'm not locking him up."
Really? Any fear? Any type of fear inside of you?
Yeah, I was scared. But what are you going to do? I got the cuffs on me. I was scared, yeah.
16-year-old in a place with hardened criminals.
I got to honestly tell you, it got easier.
It got easier to be in jail. That's interesting.
It just got easier. I knew what was going to happen.
You knew the routine.
I was going to be in the cell. They were going to do this. I was going to see the judge. And then whatever was going to happen was going to happen.
Yeah, but at some point, the judge has got to, I'm sure you went in front of the same judge multiple times. At some point, the judge is going to say, "Kid, what's going on? Like, what's the deal?" Did anybody ever stop and say, and not so much look at your bad behavior, but look at why your bad behavior was happening? Other than George Steinbrenner?
I know today that lots of times that I got locked up, I was in blackouts.
Really?
From drinking?
From drinking.
From drinking. What was your drink of choice?
Me, I drank mostly Budweiser. Then we went to Michelob. But then I went to my Grey Goose and vodka, the Grey Goose and orange juice. But I would drink shots. I would drink anything. I'm an Irishman. I would just drink.
Jameson.
But a lot of my arrests, a lot of the times when I got locked up, they were in blackouts. You know, I would wake up in the cell and didn't even know what the hell happened sometimes.
Now, your friends around you, what kind of drunk were you? Like when you got real drunk, blackout drunk.
Well, if he got locked up all the time, he was a rowdy drunk.
Yeah, but
dangerous.
Dangerous. Yeah, some people get happy drunk and they do stupid stuff. That's why I'm asking it.
No, but I was dangerous because, I would be sitting in a bar being all joyful and all of a sudden I'd hit somebody over a chair the next second, over the head with a chair.
But now, were you carrying a gun at that point when you were drunk too?
No. No, I didn't like weapons. I only carried those guns that when we did the armed robberies. That was it.
So if I'm sitting at a bar, and this is a cautionary tell to a lot of people, you never know who you're sitting next to. You might be sitting next to somebody like John Sullivan here, who's dangerous. You sound like a real dangerous guy. You know, be careful what you say. You know, be kind to people.
You buy him a drink, and next thing you know, you got a stool over your head.
Yeah. Did you ever get into any of these altercations for no reason? Or it was just, somebody inevitably will say something stupid.
There was lots of times when I was in bars where my friends would start the fights, and they knew I was there to back them up.
Don't worry about it, John's here.
A friend told me one time that this guy wanted to start a fight in the bar, but he told his friend, my friend, wait till Sully gets here. So he wanted to make sure I was there.
Those are some real good friends.
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't always like that because there was a bar called Spanky's on 75th, 76th, and 1st Avenue. And the bouncers knew there was going to be a brawl in there one night. And I was leaving. And one of the bouncers said, "I don't know, Sully, hang out, drink all you want. We need stay here.
We need you."
Because he knew I knew how to fight.
So you were used as a valuable weapon for good.
Yeah, they knew they could use my hand.
And for bad.
It's mutually assured destruction.
They said, "Where are you going?" So I said, "I'm leaving. I'm broke. Don't worry. Stay out and stay and drink. We might have a little trouble."
Now, drinking morning till night?
Morning to night.
Never stopped.
My friend used to say I could drink till the cows go to sleep, come out, and then go back to sleep.
So that's how I am. When I was drinking, it was you drink until it's over, until it's done. And when you run out, you're looking for more.
But it got so bad that people didn't want to hang out with me.
You got too rambunctious, too.
Because people want to go out and have a good time.
Yeah. And it was no longer a good time.
You didn't know when it wasn't going to be a good time. You know what I mean? I could be happy, and all of a sudden.
I'm sure your friends had to say at some point, like, "Let's not go out with Sully." Because
that's what they did.
They stopped hanging out with me.
Yeah. Yeah. Became a loner.
Yeah.
At what point did it become more than you can handle?
Not till I got older.
And we're talking what age now?
Well, when I was telling you about the guy that got shot in the back, we went to a wake. We went to the funeral. Then we went to the wake. And we went to a party afterwards at a club. And at the club, me and this other guy found a bunch of money on the floor. Probably belonged to one of the guys. We took it and we left. And we walked into another bar uptown with long hair down to here, three-piece suits. And we walked into an all FBI cop bar, Hudson Bay Inn on 76th and 2nd Avenue. We didn't know that at the time.
That's a valuable piece of information.
The hard way.
And we walked in there, and these four guys were standing in the corner, sitting in the corner, and said, look at these hippie, no good, blah, blah. I'm not going to say what they said. And we told them where they could go. And one guy cracked me with a Heineken bottle, and my friend stabbed all four of them.
Wow.
Now, the only reason we're here, I'm here, is because of the grace of God, because they were probationary cops and didn't have their weapons on them. Because I'm sure if they had their weapons on them, they would have shot us.
Wow.
So then they chased us for a few blocks. They caught us, and they beat us for 3 days.
What did they do? They took you someplace?
They took us from precinct to precinct. They beat us for 3 days before they bring us in front
of the judge. Stab a cop. Before they
bring us in front of the judge.
Now, just like your uncles when they used to beat you, what kind of reaction did you give the cops as they were beating you for three days?
I do.
I mean, did you
like you hear, they were beating us with the phone books, with the, yeah. And then the judge finally said, I want to see these, I want them to appear. And now the guy that I got arrested with had just come home from doing 4 years.
And so that looked good for you guys.
He was involved in something that was really bad back in the 70s. And they wanted him, but they needed my testimony, and I wouldn't give it.
Now, as you progress through this criminal life, when did it come to a head? Because I know you did some time, serious time.
Well, this is what happened. We go in front of the judge. He wants to go to trial. I'm not going to trial because we could get 12 and a half to 25. They're offering us 2 to 6. They're offering me 5 years parole to give him up. And I can't do that because my uncles taught me you never rat, you don't hit women, you don't
snitches, you don't go in your backyard.
Yeah. But meanwhile, they're telling me to give this kid up, and I couldn't do it. My grandmother's crying in the courtroom, and we both got 2 to 6. And today I know that saved my life, because when I was away, at least a good 5, 6 of my friends died, got killed. So I know today that was my, I call God my higher power. He removed me from the situation.
It's funny how perspectives change. Mine has changed as well. I used to hate the guy that shot at me. Now I would thank him because he put me where I was supposed to be. You get arrested, you get 2 to 6 years, which sounds tragic. You know, how old are you at this point?
I'm 63.
No.
Oh, when I got it.
When you got arrested.
I was only 20 years old.
You were 20 years old. 2 to 6 years is a big chunk of your young adult life. And you got two ways of looking at that. It's either, you know, my life is over, or, you know, you use your time valuably, but you were put in a position where you're supposed to be by whatever, you're supposed to be right exactly where you are, in a bad spot. Now, what did it feel like when you get your sentence?
It made me more angry. I was more angry than I ever was.
Yeah.
You know, but when I was away, I got my GED. And I was lucky. The judge that sentenced me, a famous judge, Harold Rothwax, Two Guns, they call him, from Part 50 in Manhattan. He wrote a letter that I should make the first board. Why, I don't know.
Well, do you think
maybe some of your friends had some?
I don't know.
Some of your friends had some pull and got to the judge?
I don't know, because the other side of my family that I never talked to are law enforcement.
So you're sitting in jail. You just got sentenced to, you know, you got sentenced to a decent sized stretch. Your first night in jail, what's going through your head besides anger?
When I got to Sing Sing, the person I talked to me said, "This, you don't even look scared." I said, it's just like changing neighborhoods. You know what I mean? It was just like changing neighborhoods. I could adjust. Yeah. I was a street kid. So once I got into Sing Sing and they gave me my state number and I went into the yard, some of the older guys took me under their wings and you'll be all right. And I said, are you scared? I said, no, I'm not scared.
Well, if you show any fear when you go in there.
I wasn't sure, no, but I was afraid I was going to hurt somebody because I didn't care anymore. Even though it was only 2 to 6, I didn't care anymore.
Is that your bottom?
No.
No?
No, just didn't care. No, it was not my bottom. No.
Well, when you lose hope.
I was just going to say, did you lose hope?
I didn't lose hope. I didn't care anymore.
Yeah.
In other words, if I had to hurt somebody in there, I would have hurt someone. I didn't care anymore.
Here's a kind of an odd question for you. It's on the outside, when you're in prison, is there anybody that you love, felt affection for, somewhat supportive? Is there anybody in your life like that?
Well, when I was in there, that's what I'm saying. I ended up going to Comstock, which is eight hours away from New York City.
Comstock's no joke.
Yeah, from Sing Sing to Downstate to Comstock. And when I got to Comstock, it's an eight-hour trip. And my grandmother would come every 2 weeks. Oh, rain, wow. Snow, hot, cold. And she came in a blizzard one day. And I said, what are you doing here? Oh, I had to come see you. You wouldn't be okay if I didn't come here. Hey, Grandma, in the snow? 8 hours on the bus from the Port Authority.
You know, I always think of before, even when you were bringing up, I wish that was a woman that was alive today. Because I would love to have her.
What was your grandmother's name?
Catherine.
Should be St. Catherine.
Yeah.
It really should.
Could you imagine having someone like that in here and getting her perspective of it?
Growing up the way I did, I wish I had a Catherine. Really, I really do wish I had a Catherine in my life.
I did.
I'm not talking about the people who loved you. I'm talking about, is there anybody that you felt love or affection for on the outside? And the reason I say that is because this not caring anymore attitude, that can only come, and your fearlessness too, to some extent, that can only come, in my opinion, when you don't love or care for something outside. Like, do you have any kids?
Well, I cared about my grandmother. I loved her in my own way, but there's nothing you could do. You're dead in there.
But, you know, and the other thing is, you're on such a destructive path, you probably didn't even care about yourself. Right? You didn't care what happened. So how do you love someone else when you don't even love yourself?
Well, do you have any children?
No. No, I couldn't take care of myself. How am I going to take care of children?
When I looked at my son, my wild and crazy behavior really ended because I loved something. I finally loved something more than myself. You know, and when you love something more than yourself, you can't be careless or reckless because they need you, you know.
You see, I was a wise Heimer because when I make parole and I come home and the parole officer says your three stipulations are no drinking, no fighting, and you got to get a job. I want you back here in 2 weeks. So I come back in 2 weeks. He said, what'd you do? I said, well, you told me I couldn't drink. You didn't tell me I couldn't bartend. So I got a job in the recovery room in my neighborhood right up the block from New York Hospital. You said I couldn't fight in the street. You didn't say I couldn't fight in the ring. So I joined the Golden Gloves. And his head spun. No, I was just a real wise.
You just found a workaround.
I just was a wise. You know? And then when I had about 46 days left, he says, I'm violating you on dirty urine because I was doing cocaine and alcohol. Hmm. And he wanted me to sign these papers or he's going to make me do the 2.5 years I did on parole. I said, I ain't signing nothing. And I said, don't even bother me. I'll do the 46 days on my head. Leave me alone. And I went to Rikers Island. And I was there for 3 days. And when Albany saw it, they said, what are you, crazy? The guy's got a job. And release him. And then when I went back to sign the papers, I spit in this guy's face.
Wow.
Spit right in his face. That I still had that rage. See, that was my big, that rage and anger. And you know what? The guys.
I think rage is a better word.
The guys in the neighborhood were calling me a cat. Because I should have been killed about 9 times. You know, I was shot once. I was pronounced dead once. 1978, I lost 2 friends.
Where'd you get shot?
I got shot in Queens Boulevard, right by the merry-go-round.
Where on your body?
On my leg.
In your leg?
Yeah, and my friend got shot to death. He got 4 bullets. My friend Johnny Sostak. And then...
So prison didn't even straighten you out.
And then 3 months later, this was in 1978, 3 months later, me and... the older brother were doing snorting some drugs, and they couldn't bring him back to life and then bring me back to life. And I spent 6 months in Bellevue Hospital. I was paralyzed on this side.
Mm.
That was the worst year. No, so I've been lucky.
Prison didn't even do anything, didn't straighten you out. And you're bordering on 30. You're getting to the age where the behavior's got to start straightening itself out. What did it?
1999. I was 29 years old. I'm homeless. I'm homeless. I'm sleeping in a cardboard box, and I don't care about nothing.
Still drinking?
Still drinking. And then I tried to come in here into Alcoholics Anonymous. I do that program, and it didn't work for me. I didn't want it. I didn't care. He's too angry. And then I went out for another 5 years, and finally I come back in 2005, and I surrendered. And
now you're living on the street for 5 years?
No, I was living on the street for 5 years. I was living, I went, actually was an older guy that lived in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. Had a two-bedroom apartment, let me live there with him. And I walked into an Italian club and with my Irish cross on, and I told them what I thought about them. And a guy piped me. And my friend Bobby took me to the emergency room, left me there with a towel wrapped on my head. He went back to the club. When he got back to the club, I was there fighting with the bartender trying to get a drink. And then he took me around the corner, and I passed out. And that was the day he took me. The next day he took me to get help.
What clicked in you when you finally surrendered? Like, what was the reason for finally surrendering?
Couldn't fight the war no more. It was a war. It became a war. I wasn't having fun anymore.
It becomes a full-time job at some point.
I wasn't having fun anymore. Listen, I was a boxer. I was pretty good with my hands, and I was blocking punches with my face. It wasn't
That's
fun.
When you know it's time to quit.
You know?
So George Carlin once gave an interview with, I think it was Jon Stewart, and he says, it was specifically about drugs and alcohol. When you first start, it's like 95% fun, 5% pain. Your hangovers suck. And then by the time you're done, it's about 95% pain and 5% joy. There's some truth to that, right? Yeah.
I just said to, you know, I'm Catholic. I said, God, I can't take this no more. I can't fight this war no more.
Either take me or get me help. And,
you know, I realized I was going into these Italian clubs with my gold Irish chain, telling them what I thought about them, hoping one of them would shoot me. I swear, hoping one of them would put one in me and it'd be over.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I couldn't live anymore.
Were you almost wishing for death at that point?
I couldn't
put yourself in the opportunity for death, I guess you could say.
I know that now, 18 years later, I know that. I wanted to die.
You were looking for it. My uncle used to do the same thing. My uncle lived in Brooklyn. And he was an Irish guy who married a Polish girl, and he lived in a Polish neighborhood. He used to go into the bar and tell Polish jokes until he got into a fight. That's what, and I often think about that. I'm like, what drove him to do that, to constantly go out and look for that violence? You know, I have an idea why, because he was one of the guys in World War II that was in Europe afterwards going to retrieve the bodies that were left on the battlefields. And I know it screwed him up, but, yeah, he used to do that, and there's several people. There's an odd person in this world that goes out and looks for violence, and you seemed like you were one of them.
Do you know how out of my mind I was that a guy said three simple things to me? He says, "You're not in the bar no more. No more cursing. You walk around with a puss on your face all the time." He says, "You know when you walk around with a puss on your face all the time, nobody cares, and you're the only one having a bad day. So I don't get angry anymore. I refuse to let anybody get me angry." But I really like to say one thing about my grandma, that she's looking down at me right now, loving me, because I'm finally the person she wanted me to be.
I think she's...
And I got tears in my eyes when I said that, because I know that I don't know who I am sometimes when I wake up now. I wake up on my bed in the morning, I want to cry, because I'm so grateful, because I just want to help people.
I was going to say, your grandma's looking down, but she always loved you. Yeah. She showed that love. But you didn't want to accept that. Right? That's what it really came down to.
In some way, do you think your grandmother understood the path you had to take? You know, you were born.
She knew I was angry.
You were born with a couple strikes against you. You know, no father, no mother, no foundation for you to build your church on.
Not to mention I was born on January 1st. They probably dropped me when I was born.
Either that or they put a top hat and a diaper on you.
They were drunk from New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Because I got a kid right now that's basically the same way I was, and I'm trying to help him. And he, you know, everything I tell him is blue, it's red, you know.
Now, does that give you, like, satisfaction now? Trying to lead someone?
I just want to help him.
Yeah.
I'm trying to tell him I did what you're going to do.
But you all been there, done that.
Right.
You're going to wind up like me.
Well, I got a bad problem with substance, either alcohol, drugs, or whatever, and I'm sitting in front of John Sullivan. What's the first thing you say to me? I'm like, you know, let's have this little role playing thing. I'm going to be a little combative towards you. You're like, yeah, they told me I got to come here. What are you going to do? What are you going to tell me?
Yeah. First of all, I got to tell you, you don't have to wake up hungover and shaking anymore.
Yeah, but you know what? The hangovers don't last that long. I'll just go out and get a couple drinks, the hangover will be gone. And I don't have to listen to this crap.
Yeah, but the black cloud that you walk around with over your head's going to go away if you stay here.
Black Cloud?
Yeah, Black Cloud. Yeah. You're in a lot of pain and a lot of darkness most of your time, aren't you? See, I believe no matter how dark it gets, that if you walk straight, there's going to be light.
That cloud's going to disappear soon.
The cloud's going to disappear. See.
Yeah, but what do you know? You're an old man.
I'm an old man. Well, let me tell you something. This old man has learned a lot because my wife told me she was sick on December 12th at 9 o'clock in the morning. And then on December 13th at 2:45 in the morning, she died.
Wow.
And I didn't run for a drink. But I wanted to know how many steps it was to the roof because I wanted to jump because I'm human. But I didn't want to drink because I know that drinking or drugging isn't going to bring her back. And it's not going to help me. I don't know if you, it's hard for you to understand that one, but.
No.
Oh, I'm sure.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
I can feel it.
That hits home more than anything else because we've all lost people that are angels in our life.
I thought she just had a cold, you know?
And we've also counted the steps.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a tough walk to the gallows that's what it is.
But I would tell somebody that walked in it that, you know, you don't have to be arrested like I was. You don't have to do time like I did. You don't have to live in the street like I did. You don't have to be pronounced dead like I was pronounced dead. You know?
What about those people that come to you and say, I like who John Sullivan is today? All right, but unfortunately, John had to go through some really bad stuff in order to be the type of person. You had to go through a 40-year education in order to be the John Sullivan that's sitting here today.
Self-imposed education.
You know, there's some value to that education that you got. You know, if I want to be like you, do I got to go through all that stuff? Or is there an easier way?
There's an easier way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could save you all that pain.
Because that's what it is. It's all pain.
It's pain.
By listening to someone who's been there.
It's pain. But I believe I'm here because of God.
and you're here to help people now.
Why didn't the other people live and why did I live? Why didn't I die and they live? You know?
Well.
My friend Mikey got hit with the thing. He died. They hit me again. I come back. You know? We both did the same thing.
Is there a possibility that you were here for a bigger purpose other than to be the tough guy, other than being the drunk? Or is it you need to, there's that one person who you're going to reach that may grow up to do something that's monumental in this world that we need as a society. Could it be there's a bigger purpose for your life?
I hope so. I really hope so. I try every day to help somebody. You know, I never wanted to help anybody in my life. I didn't care about anybody. Today, I just hope that every day I try to help one person and I'm happy. And it doesn't have to be in a program. It could be anything for any reason. Just want to help people. I never cared about anything in my life.
Well, like I said, you never cared about yourself, so why would you care about anything else?
Right. Yeah.
That's what it really boils down to. You got to love yourself before you love somebody else. Right. Now I think you have a newfound love for yourself. So now you're ready to share that love and show someone that people care about them.
All your passwords on all your accounts should be 180, because that's what it sounds like you did on your life. It's a complete 180. You went from a person that was angry, filled with pain, filled with rage. You did a complete 180. Now you're a guy who went from not caring to caring a lot, too much, probably at times. Has there ever been a time that you've tried to reach somebody to your own detriment? You know, you stay awake at night, worrying, because I know this happens to Mike and I, where we want to reach out to somebody who's in a lot of pain. And it's to our own detriment, where we may deny spending time with our families or the ones we love because this person is in so much pain. Has that ever come to pass with you?
I understand what you say. You know, we're only responsible for the effort. We're not responsible for the outcome. But I will get out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning to help somebody because that's what I'm responsible for.
You're only responsible for the effort.
Not the outcome.
Wow. Not the
outcome. No, I thought you were going to start writing as soon as I heard that one.
I'm responsible to go help that person. But whether that person wants my help or not, I'm not responsible for that. And I don't let people rent space in my head. When I go home tonight, I go home and I have a bowl of fruit every night, and then I go to sleep with a clear conscience.
Well, you can lead a horse to water, right?
Yeah. You don't
make him drink.
You don't let people get you angry in this world. No. you don't let people rent space in this in your head in this world. It's too expensive up here. You want to come up here, it's going to cost you.
You're going to pay me rent.
It's going to cost you a lot of money. But I'm responsible for the effort to help somebody. Whether that person wants to help or not, I'm not. That's up to them. I can't force the outcome. I can't force an outcome. There's no way.
You know, we're very grateful to Stuart Cherichella for introducing you to us. And I know Stewie's doing some great things with Guardian IOP in Hoboken. Are you? Is that where you're based out of? Or you met him through?
No, I've been over there. I've been with those guys. I've gone over and talked to those guys. I've been there. They've heard me.
I know they got a location in Hoboken, New Hampshire, Fort Lauderdale, Colorado.
Yeah, in Hoboken. I've gone to Hoboken.
Yeah.
I help mostly people in Long Island, but I travel. I go to Philly once a month. I go to East Stroudsburg once a month. I go to the Delaware Water Gap once a month. And then I go to Lafayette, New Jersey once a month. Yeah. And then Blairstown once a month. I go 5 times a month. I go to these places, try to help people.
You know, John, you're the living example of what a true miracle is. I've said this before on here. A true miracle is a changed life. That's a true miracle. Because there are certain people people who that have never gotten the opportunity to change their life because it was cut short too early. How does that make you feel to know that you are a living miracle?
I just thank God every day. This is God. I'm here because of him. There's only one reason that I could be here. He wants me to be here because otherwise I'd be gone.
He's got.
So I thank him every day.
And he's got more things for you to do.
Before I forget, I want to thank you guys for having me on this show.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Listen, like you say, I mean, we talked about it before the show started. You said you want to help people. As long as one person listens to this and it helps them, that's what me and Kevin do this for.
So is there anything that you want to throw out there for a plug? Where can we find you? Or listen, if you don't want to give out your information, we'll have people reach us and then we
can. You can give my number to people who need my help. It's not a problem.
All right. Yeah, so if you're looking for John.
I'm always in Long Island. You know, I'm always around. Find me. I pop up all over the place.
So Long Island's a place. Whereabouts in Long Island?
I live in East Meadow.
In East Meadow? Oh, that's a nice place. Yeah. That's, at least it was anyway. So I don't know about now.
I didn't want to move there. My wife that I was married to for 10 years, she wanted to get a house. So I took money out of my annuity. Somehow, some way, I had enough money that I worked that long that I had a pension. I actually get a pension.
Really?
I get a pension and I get Social Security. I never thought I would make it past 18.
Would be more surprised? You sitting here right now going to speak to your 20-year-old self or your 20-year-old self looking at you going, oh, my God, I'm still alive.
Yeah, the 20-year-old looking at it, still alive.
At 20 years old, did you think at 63 you'd be sitting on a suffering podcast?
No.
Yeah, but
it's an honor.
Your story's got a lot of power to it, John.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Thank you so much. And there's more people that go through it just like you did, you know.
So. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, no. I only have one more question.
Go.
Frank Sinatra or Elvis Presley?
Stop.
My Way, right?
Stop. Yeah, but who made more money with the song My Way? That was written by Paul Anka. Paul Anka wrote My Way. So none of them wrote it.
Andrew, it's 3-1 now.
Oh, Jesus. You know what? Next week's going to be the suffering of an Elvis impersonator, and then we're going to ask that same question.
But if I could add something, no matter how dark it gets in your life, you can turn it around and see the light.
Well, I think you're living proof of that.
Living proof, without a doubt.
John, we're coming to the end of this thing right now. Believe it or not, an hour is up. And I always like to end the show the same way. And I want to talk about the lessons in your suffering and what your suffering has taught you. Because if you don't learn anything from what you've gone through, you're really missing an opportunity. What do you think your suffering's taught you?
To listen.
It's tough.
To listen.
It's tough to listen. That's one of the, out of everything you just said, that's probably the toughest thing that anybody can do is to shut their mouth because you can't listen and talk at the same time. I tell my wife that all the time. She doesn't.
To listen, really, to listen.
So that's going to do it. John, I can't thank you enough for coming here.
And listen, God bless, man. I mean, you've been through it all and you came out and rose above it. That's the mark of a strong person.
Thank you.
And I think your story is just beginning.
Yeah.
At 63 years old, your life is just beginning. Isn't that something?
The best part of your life is ahead of you now. You went through all that suffering to help people. And once you start helping people, you're going to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
It's people who endure. Yeah. That is so admirable. Like, that's the things that I am attracted to. I'm attracted to people who can endure. And that's what you've done.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, real quickly, a year after my wife died, I met a girl who lost her husband at the same time. And then we met. So God's blessed me.
She didn't lose her husband from one of the bar fights you're in.
He died from drinking.
Isn't that something?
He died from drinking.
Isn't that something?
They say God works in mysterious ways.
And we met. And it's
so I'm sure you guys are like perfect together now because he was a big drinker and, you know, you went down that path and now you're.
Yeah. I won't give her a weapon.
You never give women weapons. Come on. They'll use them. That's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, The Suffering of the Streets with John Sullivan. As always, let's think about all the stuff that we learned, and there's a lot of them, so hang tight. Yeah. Anger takes so much energy. There's always a reason behind that anger and rage. You're always where you're supposed to be. You can't fight the war forever. You're only responsible for the effort, but most importantly, just listen. That's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget, you can always listen before you watch. All of our audio episodes come out on Sundays before they're aired on YouTube on Mondays. Go to popple.com for a digital business card. Put in the code TSP20 for a 20% discount. Follow us on all social media. That's LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Clapper. I know I'm missing one or two of them. Follow Mike at Mike_Fillets. Follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course, follow the Suffering Podcast. And we will see you on the next episode.